Hello everyone. Today I have Lena with us, and Lena and I are going to talk monetization. Lena comes with about 18 years of experience as a product leader in B2B, B2C and enterprise level solutions. She's currently a product advisor to many pre-seed and seed stage companies, especially gaming companies. And prior to this, she has worked as a senior director at IMVU and comes with a lot of solid retention and monetization experience, especially in the gaming and the metaverse vertical. Lena will also be a founding advisor on GChain, where they're aiming to inspire growth leaders to learn and grow from one another. With that, Lena, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this.
Absolutely. Just a caveat, by the way, me and Lena spoke a few weeks ago and the recording didn't record. So we've actually already spoken a few times. And Lena, thanks for taking the time out again to record this. And maybe this is a refined version of our earlier talk this time around.
I really enjoyed talking to you the first time. I'm sure it's going to be great second time around.
Really appreciate it. But I guess like when I spoke with Lena, just as an introduction as well, she said that, life has been a university for her, with monetization as her major and innovation as a minor. So I would love to start there, Lena, like just talk about your experiences with monetization. What have you done, in terms of projects, experiences around monetization that makes you such an expert on the field?
I think monetization, you can look at it in different ways. One is definitely optimizing the conversion for a user and finding proper packages, proper offering for you to offer them to make sure they convert better. For me, I think a little bit of the secret sauce is I have been using AI for over 10 years now to try to optimize revenue, try to optimize monetization, whether it's through personalization, different algorithm work, machine learning, but really giving users what they're looking for and building out subscriptions, upsells, and packages in a way that excite the user, where they feel like they're getting the value and they want to give you money. They feel great for what they're paying and they feel the product offering is worth them spending money on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the crux of monetization. And there's so much to unpack. I think like that's basically the theme of this podcast today, where we are going to slice and dice monetization and, bring Lena's experience to the table as well. So one thing that I'd love to start with is AI and machine learning. I know it's a hot topic, but you mentioned that you've been using it for 10 years. Could you tell us like what kind of projects and what kind of companies were already using AI and machine learning, and what has been the change with like sort of generative AI coming into the picture as well?
Many companies have been using AI, and they've been using AI more in the machine learning aspect. Generative AI has been a more recent change, and that's the difference. Many marketplaces that I worked with, we really tried to incorporate personalization, machine learning into optimizing user conversion and then really optimizing their spend. We also used Data Lake and tried to do backwards analysis to see what a paid user should look like and then try to guide users through user flows to optimize them becoming converted user. But really working with many different customers and building the most optimized marketplace from what users see when they land on it, being completely customized based on the data being fed into the machine, to recommending items that, depending on the client, will either have the highest conversion, highest amounts, spend likability, just really providing items for users to see and not wasting any of their time or your time, showing them things they're more likely to convert on. And then more recently, of course, there's been a lot of using generative AI to make sure users have a smoother onboarding experience, whether it's having a conversation with a user, generated by AI to make sure they feel like someone's there for them, to just really having an experience that someone's hands-on with the user, or there's more users on the platform, and that would make them want to spend more. So it's definitely transitioned from a lot of algorithms and machine learning and data to generative AI being used heavily to give users either a perception of or feeling of you know, connection, someone being there, someone responding very quickly. That's definitely been the change recently.
Okay. What about algorithms and machine learning in terms of the size of companies that were implementing it, right? Like in your experience, have you seen that always been the case that even the smaller companies could get on it and, you know, implement such tactics, right? Because an example that comes to mind for machine learning is like product recommendations when you're on Amazon and, you know, similar things like that, right? Is the size of the company changed? For instance, earlier you had to be an Amazon to implement this maybe, but now could you be a startup or a subscription app that's just sort of beginning to gain ground and implement these technologies more easily? Or is it still pretty difficult to get to that level of access?
I don't think it's that difficult. I've implemented extensive machine learning in companies of all sizes. I think what is more important is the amount of data you collect, the amount of users you have. If you're not being really good and checking your data, collecting data, property tagging it, data is sort of the key to having really good machine learning, you know, experience where you can monetize users. If you don't have the data, you're not going to get as much out of machine learning. Like, it would be very limited for you. So it matters less what size company you are, because anyone can implement it. It matters more how much data you have, how many users you have. If you have a very limited number of users, you're probably, it may not be the best investment for you at this point. You may want to focus on driving more users, and before you invest into engineers that can build you complex algorithms, data analysis, and predictive analysis. So I wouldn't say the size of the company matters. It's more the data sets and then the amount of users in your data sets.
You got it. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And also, I think coming to the data question, right, it's also internal data that you probably need to deliver a higher quality ML system rather than just external data. Or do you think there are ways in which you can also learn from external sources of data on, you know, on implementing monetization tactics?
It sort of depends on what you're looking at. For instance, you talked about Amazon a little bit earlier. They sort of do everything. They show you what other users who are in your bucket have purchased. If they don't have a lot of information on you, if they do, it's more customized to you. When you land on the marketplace, it's immediately, the recommendations are there based on what you've sort of had in the past. So it's really, it depends what type of marketplace you're building.
Yeah, absolutely. And Lena, maybe take a step back as well, right? I just realized that even though we have spoken last time, our listeners might not know your experience completely. Would you mind giving us a rundown of like what has been the trajectory of your career in this space and in monetization as well?
Sure. I've spent about 6-7 years in the gaming industry. Prior to that, I've spent about 11 years total working on different marketplaces across gamuts. Some were really large enterprise solutions, some were smaller B2B, and some were smaller B2C companies. So everyone from Shutterfly to ADP and smaller companies, it's really been an experience for me. And I think sort of this is why I've been trying to focus on using innovation for monetization and security. It just works hand in hand, really. And it's with so many more players in every space, you definitely want a leg up. And using new technology, which at this point, a lot of users are using cloud, using AI, trying to get a leg up, it's really game-changing for many of the customers I worked with. And this is why I went into consulting. I feel that it's really great to try to help small companies, medium-sized companies that don't feel like they can get there or they don't have necessarily a skill set or can't hire many people full-time, to, you know, show them that they could in fact get the revenue, get the conversions, get their KPIs where they want them to be. They really just need a few specialists on board, you know, walking them through it, showing them what they need to do and explaining it to them where it is possible. You don't need to be a big player in the game, but you could be very successful with different tactics.
Absolutely. And to break it down a bit further, right? When you talk about innovation for, medium or small or even large sized companies, what kind of projects are you talking about that could be interesting for these companies to be looking at, especially from an innovation perspective? What kind of things are you typically looking at for these plans?
I think it depends what they're working on. For a lot of the work I do now with monetization, I heavily implement different types of AI into the company. Again, whether it's generative AI or machine learning, AI has really given a lot of my clients a leg up. It's really allowing them to either spend less on different resources or optimize the users better. And the way I always explain it to them, it's not about cutting back on costs. It's about bringing you the best ROI for every dollar. So it's not about cutting back your customer service team. It's about giving you the best investment on an AI-driven customer service team, for example, where you could provide help to your users faster. I'm not talking about it as in let's lay everyone off and replace them. I'm really focused on what can we do better? What KPIs do you want to improve? Where do you have soft spots in your company that we can improve for you? And then, of course, depending on your technical stack, I'll make those recommendations as well, whether for some of them, because there is a lot of data work, whether it's best to migrate the customers to the cloud, security that issues they may have, just really take a look at where they are, what we're trying to achieve, and then provide them with a map of how we're going to get there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that sounds great as well. I think, and bringing it back to sort of subscriptions and subscription apps, have you experienced working with subscriptions? Because I guess like that's something that has been sort of a recent trend, at least in the non-gaming space, right? So have you seen more and more people looking at these tactics also from a subscription point of view? Because it's one thing if you're like, let's say if you're an e-commerce or if you're a transaction-based company, where I think these techniques have been sort of in play for a very long time. With subscriptions, I think it's just sort of, beginning to happen as I see it. But how do you see the subscription space evolving, and like, what kind of things companies are looking at right now, especially from a monetization and an innovation point of view?
Yes, subscription has definitely been around for a while. Let's see. When I worked at Shutterfly in 2012, we implemented a subscription model for customized greeting cards. I mean, subscriptions have been there, but we're now seeing them move more into the apps, whereas I would say 5, 6 years ago, a lot of the apps were absolutely free and they tried to get you on point-by-point transaction upsells, whereas now a lot of apps are moving to subscriptions. I mean, this personally, music to my ears. I love subscriptions. I always try to see if the customers I work with could justify or find a way to provide a subscription for their users. And the reason for that is a subscription, A, gives you huge retention leg up with your customers. If they're paying, in most cases, they're coming back. And also, your revenue per user will skyrocket. Sometimes users will buy something, then they'll walk away, then maybe they'll buy something else. Your app is just sitting there, but providing them subscriptions, it really sort of gives that next level commitment. You're not just engaged to them anymore. Like you're married. This is great. Like the income is there every month. It's a much more stable income. It's much more predictable income. And I think what is really important is when you have subscriptions, you have to build them right. I've built subscriptions from scratch and I've built revised subscriptions that were 10 years old. And it's super important to do your research and get subscriptions right so customers see value in it and so they're willing to jump on board. But then also, it's important to continue adding either features, content, whatever it is your subscription offers to get users to stay, to really minimize the churn, to understand the value of the subscription and keep providing users with that value month over month.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is also, is also very interesting from a point of view of people jumping to subscriptions because of all the benefits that you just mentioned. Sometimes maybe without realizing that it's meant to be a relationship, right? So it's meant to be something where I almost look at it as like we hire an app to solve a problem for us, and that problem kind of evolves over time. And so the app should also evolve to solve those problems with me, right? It can't be a static app. Those are the worst kind of subscriptions, I feel, where you subscribe to something and then really nothing changes, or you don't get additional value out of it over a period of time. But maybe I would love to get your thoughts on that first part that you mentioned, right? Like justifying subscription. I feel a lot of apps are moving into subscriptions because it is the trend, and sometimes they sort of fit subscription into the mold that they have. If you're an app that's just starting out, how do you typically think about justifying subscriptions for you, right? Like, how do you make that decision? What are some of the questions that you think that they should be asking themselves?
I think a lot of it has having to do with research, and that includes your own user research, your own user data, understanding how your users use the app and what they find the most valuable, and then really understanding your demographic as well as understanding your competition. You definitely don't want to outprice yourself unless you have something really magical there. Users are now very savvy. They will, price check everything. If all your competitors charge $5 a month and you provide absolutely the same service and you're charging $20 a month, you're just really shooting yourself in the foot there. So do a lot of analysis to who else is in the space, what they provide. How are you going to make yourself stand apart? And to what you said, it's not just sign up and keep going. You have to keep expanding on user needs. And so initially, a lot of user research, understanding what they find valuable, and then understand how they use it. Is this something they use many, many times a day? Then maybe you can use a freemium. There's different ways to do it. Sometimes it's best, sometimes it's best just to have a hard paywall. But most of the time, if you have a lot of content on your site, you don't want that. You want them to explore your website, and then maybe when they try to use the feature, then put up a subscription. Sometimes it's best to have a freemium, where users have a chance to use either limited time, limited capability, whatever is limited in a certain way, where you know your product is so good, if they use it for just a little bit, they're going to want to sign up for a subscription to use it more. And this is where it's important to understand the user story, user flow, what is super valuable, and then deciding how you're going to build the subscription around it. Don't make it fit into a mold. If you think you're going to put a hard paywall for every app and it's just going to convert, that's simply not true. It will work sometimes, but many times you will have to show them the content. And if you have a lot of content, why not show them how much content you have? And then, have a pop-up with the subscription upsell when they try to use it. Again, there's so many different ways to convert users to a subscription. It's just really important to understand where you stand with your users.
Yeah, I totally feel this point. And as you were saying, at mentioning, sort of the hard paywall question, I have these two recent examples of apps that I downloaded. One of them is called Paired, which is like a couples app. Have you used it, by the way?
No, it's called what?
Paired. P-A-I-R-E-D. Yeah. And it's basically like this app where you connect with your partner, and then they give you one free question per day that both of you can answer, and then you can, you can either discuss it, but basically your answers are viewable as soon as both of you answer the question. And after that, you have this explore tab where you can, when you're meeting in person again, you can take the time out to discuss the answers as well. And I personally loved that app, and it has so much content, and I enjoyed, the experience so much that I just bought their premium subscription because I just wanted more, and I could see the value that the content was already delivering. That I thought, okay, maybe it's, it's time to take this to the next level to, to explore more what the app has to say, versus an app like a Headway, which summarizes the app for you, and it has so much content. But every time I opened the app, it had this super annoying paywall that was firing again and again. And at some point, the benefit from the content was just not valuable enough for me to, to be bombarded with paywalls. And I sort of dropped, right, without exploring more of the content. So sometimes paywalls can really get in the way for users to explore the content and move forward in the journey, where I would have purchased maybe, because I do have Blinkist. And I am in that in their personas of users who buy potentially, but because just because of the paywall and how they are tackling monetization, I feel they lost me. And I'm sure that must have been the case for many other users as well, right?
Did they not try to offer you a discount after you used it for free for a while and then convert?
They had an offer right at the beginning, and then they just kept the same offer again and again. They increased it maybe at some point, but at some point I just stopped looking at the paywall because I knew when I opened the app that I was expecting a paywall, and I just had my button already, like my fingers already on the close button.
On one hand, it's not a good user experience. On the other hand, it's job security for you and me. So what can I say?
Exactly. I think the job security lies in, when I see such an experience, I actually feel that only if they were a bit more patient with people who are using the app. I mean, and thinking about it a bit more strategically than firing it on all app opens, I felt that was a bit black hat. But yeah, in your experience, right? Like, not to thrash on headway. I still love using their content. I think they have brilliant summaries. But how do you think about these, right? Because what you're mentioning around like the hard paywall versus soft paywall and looking at the content and what you have to offer to the users, sometimes it's a hard battle, right? Because sometimes you're in the lookout for revenue and you implement these kind of black hat behaviors versus maybe a paid where they are taking the long game, right? Like, they're taking the approach where they don't really bombard you, but they give you some timely offers just so that you can convert at a cheaper price. So what's your look, what's your overlook on that, right? Like, how do you, for example, if you had these two as clients, what would you be asking them to refine the strategy, for example?
So for me, there really is no one size fits all. Every app is different. There are certain apps where there really is no freemium. You're either paying or you're not. And that's, certain apps are like that. So I would try to dig more into the app. Like, what do they actually offer? Where is their value proposition? Does a user have an aha moment at any point while using the app? Like, if I gave people the app for free and then watched them use the app, where would be the moment where they like fell in love, had like a dopamine hit in the app, had really fallen in love with it? And then at that point, test having an upsell, a point, like an aha moment for a user, that point in the app where it brings them joy. And I think what's really important is, aside from obviously tracking where there's any type of drop-off, tracking conversions, tracking what pages users sit on for a while, like all that data, is really A-B test. A-B test everything. Don't make assumptions. You can continue A-B testing even after you make your initial decisions. I think that's where a lot of companies really falter. They make a call, they implement the call, and they don't continue testing. And really, there's always room for improvement, always. And so I think that's where a lot of companies make mistakes. So there is no, if there was just one playbook by which to go on, no one would sort of need to investigate anything. But there isn't one single playbook. Every app is different. Every customer base for that app is different. Their value proposition is different. Even their amount and quality of content is different. So really, you watch the user, you understand your user, interview them, do user research and watch how they use the app, and then start testing when you show them the upsell. Could be faster, could be slower, could be waiting, you know, for a dopamine hit moment before you give an upsell, whatever it is, but do keep testing to understand what's best for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely echo that as well. I think A-B testing, and not only just like, I think at least from my perspective, I've seen that A-B testing was limited to, you know, that initial experiences were sort of set in stone in terms of onboarding. Let's say you hit a paywall, etc. And then what I always used to see is like more A-B testing around, you know, the content that we send to convert them and things like that. But over the last year or two, right after COVID, I feel like the industry has seen a change where they are also looking at how to A-B test paywalls, how to A-B test pricing. And so sort of testing those metrics even more than what they used to do 5 years ago, right? And I think for subscription, yes, that can be a big game changer.
Right. Are you going to have, you know, a $5, $10, $15 subscription model if you have enough content to justify having different amount of access? Or are you going to test paying monthly, quarterly, yearly? but for the same amount of access. Is it worth it to have two different types of packages, one, three? It's super important to test. And you can test pricing, you can test everything. But yes, if you have a huge amount of content, maybe you have the gold, silver, platinum, which I've implemented at the gaming company, and it did extremely well because sometimes you just want to get a user any subscription, even if it's a cheap subscription, because you know they're going to migrate to the higher paid subscription later. You're looking at it from a long game. You want a higher conversion to paid. Whereas sometimes you just have the same content if you're depending on what type of app you are, and then your option is you want to pay me every month, every quarter, every year. Then you play around with discounts for the year, so people want to pay for the year, and that's what you're testing there. So you should test everything. I absolutely agree with you.
That's super nice. And also, talking about testing these things, right? Like one aspect of it is that the accessibility has increased, right? Like, so you are able to test these things more easily, let's say, and in a more manageable way than a few years ago. One, it's still hard to manage though, right? Like, it's still hard to make a strategy for these things, right? Like, there needs to be a roadmap of what you want to sort of test there. So although in my experiences, what I have been seeing is that companies don't often have this very good or very well-prioritized roadmap built up for testing around subscription paywalls, pricing, plans, tiers. Because the smaller companies, they sort of go crazy, right? They copy the competitor that they're trying to beat. And then the bigger companies don't have so many users already on some plans that it's very hard to move away from that and, you know, test pricing again and again. So what's your thoughts on that? What are your thoughts on that, right? Because when you're A/B testing, depending on the size of the companies, does it matter? Or do you think there's some way that you would think about A/B testing these things? Where would you start? What questions would you ask yourself?
I don't think it matters what size company you have. I think what does matter is if you have a smaller user base, you need to wait for your test to hit, you know, statistical significance. And it really just kills me when people run a test and the first day they see this huge upswing somewhere. They're like, yes, I win, period, close the test, move on. They're not watching 10 other KPIs that could be negatively influencing. They're not realizing maybe it's 5 users who just somehow landed or got scammed out of their credit card and someone else just signed up for it. They're not letting it get to a statistical significance, and they're not watching all their data. And I think that is where people make mistakes. If you're a small company and you have small number of users, that's okay. It takes you longer to complete the test and get the result. But you should still be testing as much as everybody else. It just takes you longer to close the test. And I think that's the other thing I want to just mention. Don't watch one number. Don't watch conversions. Don't watch the spend. Watch everything. Sometimes you could be negatively impacting users by showing them a pop-up every 2 minutes. Are you watching your drop-off for these users? Are you watching like where they're dropping off? It's really easy to just be like, oh, of course, if I show a pop-up every 3 minutes, my conversion to paid for users will eventually go up just because someone will get tired. But is your user retention now down 10-20% because users who are not paying now and maybe would have converted a week from now are simply sort of through with you? So
yeah,
it's really important to watch all the KPIs, and everyone should be testing regardless of their size. And there are now so many third-party tools, you know, which you could use. In the past, it was super limited. Everything had to be built in-house, and I've built it all in-house. And building it in-house to test between, you know, across all the platforms to give you the same experience was not that simple. But for certain companies, that's what you have to do. And in the past, there were companies that were super expensive, you know, Optimizely for large enterprise customers where you can do it. But there's now so many more small companies that came up. You know, you have Purchasly, which, you know, can help you do that. There's just, you know, so many competitors now that will help you test. And I think like Adapt.io, there's many. And I think you should look at them, talk to them, see what their capabilities are. And if you don't want to build anything in-house, use a third-party service.
Yeah. On that, by the way, since you've built it in-house, I'm keen to understand, like, if have you ever received that question of should we build it in-house or should we get third-party tool more recently? Because the third-party tools are so powerful that but they can get expensive as you grow, right? So
yes.
Have you received those questions, and how do you typically tackle them? Because I have my own thoughts on it, but I would love to get your opinion as well.
It heavily depends on your number of users. I did an analysis, I want to say 3-4 years ago, for a company with 100 million users, where it was so expensive to use a third party that we already had a basic tool in-house, investing a little bit more time into it and being able to run our own tests. Made a lot of sense. And then it also gave us more control about the data. We were migrating to cloud at that point. That's what we're storing. It just made sense. For smaller companies, see if you can get a trial. Try it out. See what the costs are. I think you should understand the fee structure. Again, you can be looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, depending on your customers. And what's really important to understand is you may not have a lot of money, but you may be made by your customer. But you may have a lot of free customers that you're testing. And then you will start running up bills at a much faster pace than you think, paying a third party. So it's just really important to understand what you're paying for, what all the capabilities are, and what is the cost of implementation. Sometimes third-party companies also are not easy to implement, and then you're sort of stuck with them. So just really understand all the costs and understand, like, when you grow in a year, what is that bill going to look like? That don't look at it from just right now point of view, because you're going to spend so much time implementing a solution that if you expect to grow tenfold in a year, may get astronomically expensive. So just really be smart about it and talk to them, discuss it, pre-haggle your spending if you grow. You know, a lot of these companies are willing to discuss with you, like, if I grow tenfold year over year, I will get this much more discount from you. They're willing to work with you. They're great sometimes. And you should just make sure everything's negotiated ahead of time, so you're not sort of stuck with a fund bill. I've seen that happen before.
Yeah, so am I. I think that's a very good call out as well. I think a lot of times you make that decision based on current scenarios and you feel like, okay, if I can get that 5%, 10% uplift, it should be worth it. And then you go ahead with it, but you sort of have to take into account how much you're growing month over month, right, as well, and sort of make that scenario analysis for 1 year later. I also feel that you have these tools that can really help you stay up to date with industry standards, right? Because if you are not going to be heavily invested in making a tool yourself, there are so many changes that happen on an yearly basis in the Apple Store or, you know, in the Play Store, that these tools can sort of take care of that for you. And then you have that part taken care of without needing like an engineering team to look into it. So I think there's another added benefit there, that in general, if you have these tools, you also have to account for the teams that you're not going to hire in the future just to take care of that entire subscription revenue generation and, you know, just sort of management piece as well.
I completely agree. I think it's just so important to look at how it's going to give you something now and then what that's going to look like 1 year, 2 years from now. Just really understand all your decision points. Because like you said, those tools, you'll probably never build anything as robust because that's not what you're in the business of building. But you definitely want to understand like where this tool may hit its limit in terms of what you want and where you're going to be a year from now or 2 years from now with the tool. And again, everything's negotiable. And this is when you're starting out and you're signing onto a service, this is your biggest time to negotiate with that company. You could pre-negotiate much more discounted rates with them, saying that if I grow tenfold year over year, you will give me 20, 30, 40% discount on what the bill would be. Like, when you're not a customer yet, that is your biggest negotiation point. Once you're a customer, yes, they'll negotiate with you a little bit, but, you know, be smart about it. Be smart of who you choose. Make sure you get good support with your customer service representative at that company. And like you said, they will have features you'll probably never build out because that's not what you're in the business of doing. And there's so many perks to using a third party.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I also see is just the owning of monetization as an issue. I work with this third party tool called Classify, where I was interviewing a lot of folks in the subscription space and asking companies who owns monetization. And basically what I heard back was very, very different, right? Because there were all these companies that either had no clear owner of monetization. And when I say monetization, I mean, no one was really in charge of looking at how are our conversion rates in the first day. You know, what does it look like after 1 week? Are we optimizing for the paywalls? Have we price tested anything? You know, do we have demographics where we need to lower the prices? For example, I still see so many apps in India who have huge free user bases, but then they just fail to monetize because it's just very expensive here as per the local standard. So Have you in your experience seen, you know, some teams owning monetization, like, and these aspects of it, when it comes to, for example, testing, packaging, pricing, paywalls, etc.? I feel a lot of times there is a tool issue where you just don't have the capacity to do it. But once you have the tools, it's also just having that resource in-house who can take care and, you know, and run with it and sort of test things in a systematic way. Who typically owns that in the companies that you worked with? And, you know, what are your opinions on who should own it technically, right? Like, where should it sit and who should be reporting on it? What should it look like?
I've seen it being owned by marketing and or by product. And the joke is, if conversions is going well, marketing will want to own it. And if it's not, it definitely belongs to product.
That's so true.
And you know, it's true.
Yeah, I know it's true. Completely.
But I personally, I'm from the product side, and I like to own a lot of the data. I like to own a lot of the monetization, and sort of that's sort of my personal preference. However, there are certain pieces like marketing, emails, notification, messages, all the communication with customers. Tracking that back usually lives with marketing. And then there's sometimes teams that sort of try to straddle both, and they try to be responsible for a lot of the monetization tactics. For instance, when I do projects as product for new subscriptions, I always have marketing and sales team involved because I want to make sure, you know, we are a cohesive team. We are all on the same page about what new subscriptions we're going to put out. It's a lot about communicating laterally and horizontally. But then usually building out the subscriptions, what goes in them, the pricing, it usually falls on product. Whereas again, sort of any of the marketing and communications and emails and push notifications, a lot of times even these customized messages to bring users back, discounts, they will fall in marketing. But I think it's super important for whoever it falls on to sort of work together. I feel in many companies, there's a huge disconnect. And it's sort of like product and marketing. It's a hot potato. Again, if it's doing well, it belongs in marketing. If it's not, it belongs in product. And it shouldn't be like that. It should really be a cohesive ownership because you each own a part of it. It should be like one is always involved. I've had times where I've had marketing people sent an obscene amount of push notifications. And I didn't even know until I saw the push notification opt-ins go down, and I'm like, what the hell's like, why are people opting out? And I'm like, really, dude, no one needs 5 push notifications a day. Like, you're not doing me any favors here. So I feel like it's really important to just work together on this, keep each other like abreast of the situation, have your own roadmap of all the changes, have your own roadmap of all the projects, and make sure everybody's on the same page. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I completely agree, and I've seen the best setup. I've seen so many setups also from these interviews around how people have been, you know, have been tackling these things. And yeah, it's funny because sometimes with smaller companies, I also see founders being very, of course, for good reasons, being very involved in all of these decisions. But then they're driving the things that they want to test and with no clear ownership from like a product team or from marketing to move that metric as them being the key owner of it. The system that I have seen worked, that has worked the best, is when you have almost like a squad where you have one product owner with some resources or a third party tool plus a marketeer who also can be like the touch point with the marketing team. And yep. I think that has worked the best in my experience so far.
I agree. It has to be that hand-in-hand mentality. It can't just be mine, yours. You have to be working together. Good example is like upsells. Who owns upsells? Always product. Product will come up with different upsell capabilities. And I'm not talking about like a sale. I'm talking about opportunities to upsell users, whether it's based on what they're currently researching. You know, oh, this is not available, but here's this. Or, oh, it's not available for free, but please use a subscription. To here's a package to buy more credits. That's usually owned by product. So it is that hand-in-hand mentality where you can't have one party be in the dark about a piece of something that's going on with the customer. You really, someone has to own it, but work together with marketing.
Yeah. And I've seen this as a CRM person, right? Like I have seen it being usually the case that whenever we form these kind of cross-collaborative projects with the product team, there is just so much because each field has sort of moved on and is doing a lot, knows a lot about their own strengths, right? And for example, this example always comes to mind where I was talking to a product team about a certain product feature that they wanted to upsell. And they had no idea about where the push opt-in was asked for the users. And they had no idea about the opt-in rates for push or email. And as soon as I told them that the rate was, you know, so much, they just all were so surprised by it. And they were like, okay, what can we do there? And coming from a CRM perspective, like from the CRM world, you are so ingrained in these topics that you almost take it as a no-brainer. You feel like everyone in this world knows what the best practices are. But I think that's where the strengths really come into play. And as CRM teams, we often don't do so much user research. And we don't generate hypotheses from, you know, that are rooted in deep user research. And I feel product teams have such wealth of user research that they've done and persona studies that if you spend even some time talking to their UX researchers or, you know, just the product team in general, you get to know so much about your users. So I feel there's just so much that both these teams bring to the table that you basically need to solve the monetization equation, you know.
I agree. I also feel like everyone should be dog-fooding their own product. Use your own product. Have your engineers, have your product, have your marketing people. They should all be using the product. Like, you cannot not use your own product. And also, know your data points. I know it's a lot, but I feel like every day you should be looking at certain data points. Once a week, you should be looking at a much more extensive list of data points. It's really important to be data and user-driven. No matter what your title is, no matter what team you're on, use the product, know your user, know your data. I think that will make you the most successful in deciding which projects to focus on and deciding what's next for the company.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think we've spoken a lot about monetization today as well. And, you know, just around what type of packaging people should be thinking about and building in-house versus getting a third-party tool as well as, you know, as well as team structures. One last thing that I'd love to get your opinion on is you recently gave this talk when we were together in San Francisco where you spoke about optimizing monetization through use of AI and machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
Apart from what we have spoken about already, is there anything else that you'd like to add there, just given that a lot of people have been looking into it and I still feel there's a lot of noise but not a lot of action yet. How do you recommend someone optimize monetization? Like what area should they be looking into? And yeah, if you have any tips or tactics that people can, you know, sort of take away from this talk.
I think if you're going to focus on anything, focus on giving users a very personalized experience that feels like home, like it feels like it's made for them. If nothing else, use AI to give users an experience based on them. Whether it's, let's say you have a marketplace and they land in the marketplace, what they see right off the bat, even banners, everything should be customized to the user's taste. And there's so many ways to do this. If you have enough user data, you can use it based on that particular user's previous purchases, previous clicks, where they hover the longest, what they do on your app.
whether it's what games they play, what videos they watch.
Use all your user information and use that with AI to generate content that's unique for them. They should always feel like things are customized. In the past, it was really difficult. You still had to write machine learning, but algorithms, but there was a lot less data you could use. Now it's almost infinite. Now it could be really on the fly. And then continue optimizing it for your users. That's what AI is for. It's not just, oh, they came from this ad, which has something on it. And then their whole experience is sort of colored by what was on that ad. It should really continue evolving the more data you build on a user. So maybe they came through a certain ad about fall clothes, but as they're shopping, they're going to Hawaii, they're buying a bathing suit, they're looking for something in the color, like material, whatever it is. And as their experience with you evolves, so should what you present to them. Users react best if it's customized. So if nothing else, make sure what users see in your product feels customized to them. They're a lot more likely to spend money on it then.
Yeah, that's a very good summary of where should you be looking at. And also, like, this is a theme, right? Because I agree, a lot of noise is sometimes in the tactics, and we are looking at only one part of the funnel or one aspect of optimizing user experience, but you need to be looking a bit more broader picture as well. One example that comes to mind is recently I had a client where basically if you dropped off, for a few days, we were sending you notifications to bring you back to the app. And initially those notifications were manual, right? In the sense that we were writing copy, we were generating hypothesis based on user experiences and user research. And what we found is, like, as soon as I wouldn't even call it like super high scale AI, but we asked AI to generate like more and more content so that it refreshes. And we had already like a bunch of hypotheses that we wanted to test. I think we tested 160 variants within a matter of 1 month because the volumes allowed for it. Mm-hmm. And the retention after that, the week next, retention increased by about 4%. And I felt like that was just such a small funnel that we might have optimized. And we saw some benefit out of it. I can't even imagine if you do that for your, if you apply that mentality to all your experiences and sort of implementing it all across your life cycle or all across your efforts, this could be super valuable.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Users like a certain tone. They want to be shown certain things. Sometimes it's even a specific discount. Sometimes it's no discount. And it's really using all the information you have on the user to communicate with them in a most optimal way.
Very great, Lena. Very nice talking to you. And I had one last question before we end this conversation. Is what is one thing about your work that you feel is a super powerful insight, but doesn't get the attention that it deserves? What is something that you feel is just not spoken about enough and you feel you just don't get it? Why are people not discussing this, or why they should be? If you have something, no pressure.
No pressure. What did I say last time?
I wish I had the recording.
I wish we had it too. I think the most important is I find it sometimes very shocking how little people who work at certain companies know about their own user data and about their users. They don't interview them. They don't talk to them. And aside from conversion, retention, and, revenue per user, they don't look at other data points. And I think that's super undervalued. There is so much unique information about user feedback, knowing users through numbers and knowing users through research. And I think we talked about it last time. You talked about reading user reviews, using AI to, summarize user reviews. But there's sometimes really big pearls in reading reviews, talking to users. Watch them use your app on user research. Watch where they're having problems. Almost every time I've watched users use an app, there's always a moment or two where they're really struggling. And you want to know where those are or where they're really enjoying the play or use. You want to understand your users, again, both
quantitatively and just analytically. And it's so important. And I think it's, you know, undervalued. And I think to really provide the best experience for them, you need to know them. And for me, again, user research data, most important.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Lena, again. And on parting notes, if you want to let listeners know where they can find you, if they want to work with you, or if they want to get in touch with you, it has been a pleasure talking to you today again. And to get more insights, I wish we had the recording from the first one, because I feel we covered a lot more topics as well in the first one that I don't remember anymore. But I really appreciate you having you here and sharing your thoughts today.
Thank you. People can find me on LinkedIn, Lana Dubinsky, lanadubinsky.com, and email me, lanadubinsky@gmail.com. Really, if you Google me, you should be able to find me. Please ping me. I'm super responsive, especially on email and LinkedIn.
Thank you so much, Lana, for being here today.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Have a nice Thanksgiving.
Yes, I'm prepared for my turkey day.
Very nice.